Good morning. It is an honor and pleasure to be with you here today. I had the chance a few weeks ago to meet with your pastor. We met over lunch, and I was able to get to know him a little bit better, and he was able to get to know me a little bit better. And I just wanted to let you know that you guys have an absolutely wonderful pastor who absolutely loves the church. My name is Timothy Hallstrom, and I'm a student at Cincinnati Christian University. I have a year left in my Master of Divinity program, after which I would like to preach and teach and serve the church in any way which God would have me. Before that, I was in Missouri for 2 years, finishing my undergrad at Central Christian College of the Bible, and then before that, I was in Arizona. Now, it's been quite the transition from Arizona to Cincinnati, where I now live. In Arizona, Vivaldi only plays 2 seasons, summer and winter. But here you guys actually have all 4 seasons, and I have to confess, I really couldn't get fall and spring straight until I moved here and I saw leaves actually falling from the trees and things actually springing from the ground. But I've loved the weather and I've loved being here these last few years. When I have free time, what I like to do most with my time is I like to read. I like to read classic literature such as Jane Eyre, Moby Dick, Tale of Two Cities. I also like to read contemporary literature. One that's on the New York bestseller list for like a year and a half is All the Light We Cannot See, and I enjoy reading those types of novels as well. And then when I'm just really tired of doing school, I like to read nonsense literature such as Alice in Wonderland or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But I love reading because I love stories. And today we pick up in the story of Jesus 3 days after he was crucified. And we pick up the story where these 2 disciples are walking. And they're doubtful yet hopeful because it's the 3rd day. And Jesus is supposed to arise. By the end of the story, they recognize the resurrected Jesus. Their faith is confirmed, their lives transformed. And all this because Jesus didn't stay in the grave. Because he was resurrected. And this fact is so essential because Christianity stands or falls on the fact of the resurrection of Christ. Paul says as much in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, if Christ had not been raised, our faith is worthless. We are still in our sins. If Christ had not been raised, then we of all men are most to be pitied. Butler comments, he says, this is the message that separates followers of Jesus Christ from all other people of the world. If Christ is not risen, we of all people most foolish. He goes on, the church must constantly ask why it believes in the resurrection and what difference that belief makes. And so today we ask, why do we believe in the resurrection? Because Easter doesn't mean a thing without the risen king, and so we look at the story of the Emmaus Road, and we find 3 strands of evidence for why they believed in the resurrection and why it transformed their lives. The first strand of evidence we see is the empty tomb itself. In the second half of their explanation to Jesus, when Jesus says, what things? In the second half of this explanation, they say this, but we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the 3rd day since all this took place. In addition, some of the women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. Now today, even, the empty tomb remains strong evidence for the resurrection. The essential question is, why wasn't there a body in the tomb? And today, 2,000 years later, the resurrection remains the best explanation for that question. But some who want to deny anything supernatural, that anything supernatural could have happened, so they attempt naturalistic theories to explain the resurrection, natural ways in which Jesus wasn't in the tomb. One of them is what's called the apparent death hypothesis. They say Jesus was not completely dead, but what the Princess Bride would call mostly dead. Jesus was not completely dead, but snuck out of the tomb to convince the disciples he had risen from the dead. But this theory outside of the resurrection has at least 3 problems. The first is the Roman executioners themselves. A Roman executioner was a paid professional to make sure that you were dead. And they weren't going to mistake that. After you had been beaten and crucified and they thrust a spear in you, they weren't going to confuse a dead man for a man that was alive. But secondly, if Jesus did survive all that and he was in the tomb, do you expect a man beaten from an inch of his life to be able to be inside that tomb and roll the stone away by himself and sneak past two guards? And what's more, if he had done all of that and then he appears to the disciples, this Jesus who preaches power over death, do you think that would be a very convincing message in the state that he was in? It's not likely. And so the apparent death hypothesis is unconvincing. Others would like to do what's called the conspiracy hypothesis. They say that the disciples stole the body of Jesus and they lied about his resurrection appearances, thus faking the resurrection. But this has the major problem of explaining why the disciples would die for a lie that they themselves invented. Why do we see the disciples at the end of the Gospels so distraught and distressed, and then turn completely so that in the book of Acts they're willing to be martyred and give their lives completely for Jesus? It doesn't seem like they were doing that on a lie. And lastly, some people go so far as to posit what's called the wrong tomb hypothesis. They say the women, just they got the wrong tomb. They were in tomb 7, Jesus was in tomb 8, and they were like, you know, hey, it's empty. Jesus must have been raised from the dead. But the problem with this one is anybody, especially the enemies of Jesus, would say, well, fine, let's go double check. And they would have gone back and verified it. So how do you explain the empty tomb outside of the resurrection? Now, in addition to the empty tomb, another strand of evidence we see in the story on the road to Emmaus is that of prophecies. And Jesus actually chastised the disciples for not believing all the prophecies about him. It picks up in verses 25 and 27. It says, Jesus said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer all these things and then enter into his glory?" And beginning with Moses and the prophets, Jesus explained to them all that was said in the scriptures concerning himself. So what was said in the scriptures concerning him? Some of the clearer prophecies are these. First, that his bones would not be broken. Psalm 34 says, he keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Also, that the Messiah, whoever the Messiah would be buried in a rich man's tomb. Isaiah 53 says, his grave was assigned to be with wicked men, yet with a rich man in his death. Or it says, the hands of the Messiah would be pierced, both his hands and feet. And Psalm 22 says, a band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and feet. Now, some of you might object and say, hey, now wait a minute. I can fulfill some of those prophecies myself. I haven't had any bones broken, but that doesn't make me the Messiah. Now, the problem with that, though, is the Old Testament contains over 300 references that were fulfilled in Jesus. And the question isn't if you fulfill one or two of the prophecies, but if you fulfill all of them. So perhaps you may have gone through life without having a broken bone, but were you born in Bethlehem? Were you from the tribe of Judah? Were you sold for 30 pieces of silver? And you add 294 more to that, and it becomes utterly improbable that any man would have been able to fulfill all of these. And so then you have to ask, how do you explain all these prophecies, which were all fulfilled in Jesus? Now, critics would like to push back and say, well, of course, anyone can prophesy something after that thing had happened. For example, you guys wouldn't be very impressed if I told you today that I prophesy that in the Final Four, Villanova is going to be Oklahoma by a margin of 44 points. You would say, no, wait a minute, you just checked NCAA.com, and I'm sorry if I ruined that for any of you guys if you had that on TiVo. But critics want to push back and say, well, you can prophesy anything after the fact. The problem with this, though, is if you do not accept the traditional date of the prophecies being 450 years before, you at least have to accept the date of 250. Because by that time, the entire Old Testament was translated into the Greek language by the year 250 under the rule of Ptolemy Philadelphus. So you cannot have these prophecies any earlier than 250 years. So 250 years prior, Over 300 prophecies, all fulfilled in Jesus. But lastly, you have the empty tomb, you have the prophecies, and lastly, the third strand of evidence we see in this Emmaus Road narrative is the manifestation of Christ himself. The story goes this way. It says, when he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and he began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. Now, for our sake, it's important that more than just these two people saw Jesus and his resurrected body. Because many people want to say, well, it was just a hallucination. They just saw Jesus because that's what they wanted to see. The problem with that, though, is Jesus didn't just appear to these two. Jesus appeared to over 500 people at one time. And you don't get hallucinations of 500 people all seeing the same thing. And Paul details this more in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time. Then he appeared to James. Then to all the apostles. Last of all, he appeared to me. So the resurrection appearances were private and public. To individuals and to multitudes, these were not hallucinations. Daryl Bach, a biblical commentator, says, such experiences push the disciples from the category of skeptic to persuaded. And so the final scene of this story in the narrative is their response. Because it's all well and good to have a resurrected Jesus, but if we don't respond to that, it doesn't mean anything. The resurrection requires a response. And respond is exactly what they did. It says, they got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. They found the 11 and those with them assembled together and said, it is true, the Lord has risen. What then, I ask you, is our response? What is our response to the resurrection? Because we can have Good Friday and we can have Easter services and we can believe all these things, but if we don't act upon that, what use is it? And so there's two responses here today I want to challenge you with and I want to leave you with. The first is to believe that there may be some of you in these pews who've never considered the resurrection, or you're skeptical or you're doubtful. And if that's you, if that matches your description, I would challenge you this next week, these next 7 days, to meet with your pastor. Daniel would love nothing more than to talk with you about Jesus and the resurrection. And you can probably get him to buy you some coffee too if you're at it. But he would love nothing more to sit down and talk with you. So if you've been putting this off, I challenge you, think about it. Don't sit on the fence. You have to come down what you believe on the resurrection. The question is of eternal importance. Now, secondly, I realize there are many of you who have been believing that fact long since before I was born. And if that's you, I would challenge you to testify. Tell other people about the resurrection. And this may be something you've done in the past but haven't done so recently. And it's really easy, especially me in particular, to just get really comfortable around your Christian friends, and you just feel really safe because you all believe the same things. You might disagree on politics and sports, but you pretty much agree on the same things religiously. But this isn't something we can keep to ourselves. This is something we constantly have to be telling other people. Let them know about the resurrection. Don't let the social stigma hinder you. In Acts 17, people were still being mocked for sharing their faith. In Acts 17, we pick up the story of Paul. And Paul has given a knockout sermon to the Athenian, Epicurean, and the Stoic philosophers. And he gets down to his sermon, and when he mentions the resurrection, it says this. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered. And when you mention the resurrection, some people are going to sneer too. If for no other reason, then some of the top atheistic thinkers are encouraging their followers to do just that. Richard Dawkins, who is a professor at Oxford and one of the most well-known atheists, he wrote The God Delusion. In response to how should we treat Christians, he says this, mock them, ridicule them in public, Don't call for the convention that we're all too polite to talk about religion. Religion is not off the table. Religion is not off limits. Religious makes specific claims about the universe which need to be substantiated, which need to be challenged, and, if necessary, need to be ridiculed with contempt. Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, another very famous influential atheist, says this: mockery of religion is one of the most essential things. But instead, I would challenge you with Paul's words in Romans 1:16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for salvation to all who believe. If you were a doctor and you had the cure for cancer, you found it, and all of your colleagues didn't believe you, and they were mocking you, saying, we're not going to find cancer in this generation, we're not going to find the cure for it, would that keep you from distributing that medicine to everyone? I doubt it. We have the solution for sin. Let us not keep it to ourselves. Chuck Swindoll says this. He says, because he was raised, we also will be raised. Because he was raised, sin can be forgiven. Because Christ was raised, death is not the final conqueror. Because he was raised, Satan's doom is sealed and sure. So we can respond to the resurrection by disbelief or by belief. We can be passive or we can testify, but we cannot remain neutral. Either the tomb was empty or it wasn't. Either Christ was raised from the dead or he didn't. If we believe the prophecies, the empty tomb, and the resurrection of Christ, let's join the disciples in saying, it is true. Christ has risen. The resurrection requires a response. What's our response? Thank you.